Picture yourself on a tropical beach. White sand, turquoise water, all that. You dive into the clear water and are immediately surrounded by thousands of colorful fish. A coral reef unfolds under you with a million colors and shapes and textures. Now picture that same coral reef. The coral is bleached. The fish are few. The sounds of a healthy reef, the snap, crackle, pop of shrimp, are gone. More and more, our coral reefs are starting to look and sound like the latter. Temperatures are rising and the acidity of ocean water is changing. Yeah, climate change is happening, and coral reefs and the biodiversity they harbor are some of the first climates seeing themselves out. You're probably already aware of this. It's been happening for the last several decades and is only projected to get worse. The Great Barrier Reef off the shore of Australia is the world's largest and longest reef system, and already 91% of the corals surveyed in 2021 to 2022 showed signs of bleaching.
But what you don't know is that scientists are turning to some surprising tactics to try to save these corals, namely storing their sperm away for safekeeping. In today's episode, we'll be speaking with one of the scientists working in the race against time to bring all known coral species into captivity in order to buffer them against possible extinction. The goal of this episode is to understand how humans, who, by all accounts, have been the biggest contributors to climate change, are working to save species threatened by the consequences of rising temperatures.
We will be speaking with a Florida lawyer who is on the front line of policy changes that might save plants and animal species on the Florida Peninsula from rising sea levels. Her work revolves around an assisted migration, or a Herculean task of quite literally uprooting these species and transplanting them to a safer location.
Our last guest is a scientist who has worked to save the world's rarest fish, the devil's hole pupfish, a tiny sapphire blue species that lives, of all unlikely places, in a 90-degree, living room-sized pit deep in the Nevada desert. Despite its unique tolerance to high water temperatures and a small environment, climate change and increased urbanization are conspiring to threaten this unlikely omen of changing times. The pupfish is so threatened, with only a few hundred individuals left, that scientists have gone straight to their genes to try to figure out how we can preserve these fish for later generations.
Stay tuned to hear the inside story on how these three scientists are shaping our world and the creatures in it to preserve the health of our environment.
This
is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
My name is Mary Hagedorn. I'm a senior research scientist at the Smithsonian National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute in Washington, D.C., and I'm an affiliate faculty at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. What I do in my laboratory is I work on using human fertility techniques and I apply it to coral reefs to try and save them. And specifically what we do is we use cryopreservation to freeze coral sperm, coral larvae, and small pieces of coral and coral symbionts. And so we're trying to create this frozen library that can be used today to help diversify shrinking populations on the planet, but also for the future, because these samples can be frozen and maintained alive for tens and theoretically for hundreds of years. They might be used to help reseed populations of corals once the oceans have returned to more, let's call it pre-industrial conditions, if that's even a thing.
Mary hopes that this frozen library can serve as a repository to restore coral species that are threatened once and if the ecosystem stabilizes and are able to support coral species once more. To do so, she travels the world to collect samples of coral and add them to this library. Already, she has species from Florida, Australia, French Polynesia, and the Caribbean. And she hopes to bring species from the Red Sea, the Indian Ocean, and other rich marine environments from around the world. But this task is daunting.
There's approximately 1,000 stony coral species. We have about 1/4 of those in captivity as we speak. We don't have a lot of genetic diversity, so in some cases we might only have, one individual in captivity. In other cases, we have many. So what we're trying to do at this point is broaden our genetic diversity, either, you know, live in captivity or in, you know, live frozen in our cryobanks, and to increase our overall number of species. The most recent work that we did around that was 2018. We did assisted gene flow, where we had coral that had been, coral sperm that had been frozen across the Caribbean, and we crossed those with fresh eggs from Curacao, and we reared those larvae in Florida. And so many of the larvae, the larval crosses that are from the same species, Elkhorn coral or Acropora pomata, are now being grown out in captivity in Florida. And we're hoping that at some point we might be able to put those, they're now 3 years old, those back out into the wild, or at least test them to see, they have much more genetic diversity than what is available right now in Florida. Acropora pomata are endangered, and there's only about 300 genetic individuals left. So we could ostensibly diversify that population very quickly if we were given permission to put those back out.
The hope is that when the time is right, these corals can be resuscitated, reconstituted, thawed out. I'm not really sure what the formal technology is here, from their frozen state to reintegrate back into the marine community.
From the very beginning, we have done that, so really since 2007. But we know that we can thaw the sperm, we know that we can fertilize the eggs, we know that they develop normally, and we know that they settle normally and take up symbionts.
So, the coral fragments and sperm cells are spending their days in a frozen state. We know that we can bring them back, and they seem to behave normally. A big question I had, though, was how do we get the sperm there in the first place?
Like if someone were to go into a clinic to enhance their family, they might want their sperm frozen. They might want to have their embryos frozen. And we use many of the same techniques, although it's harder for coral than it is for humans. Humans have very tiny cells. The sperm of coral and the sperm of humans is about the same. So it's more or less the same process. But a human embryo is very tiny. They're only about 100 microns in diameter. You cannot see them with the naked eye. Coral larvae is huge. I mean, they're almost a millimeter across, some of them. So they're quite large.
For reference, a human egg, which is already one of the biggest cells in our bodies, is only about a tenth of that size.
As you scale up in size, you're moving away from sort of cellular cryopreservation to something that is more like an organ. And that's why some of the stuff that we're doing right now, fragment cryopreservation, is really very akin to organ cryopreservation. And we're using many of the same techniques that will be available to us in the future for organ cryopreservation.
Getting the sperm in the first place requires little more than just a bucket of water and a pipette. Corals only release their sperm at certain times of the month or year, so one needs to first identify and collect corals that are on the verge of spawning. Once they spawn, the heavier eggs tend to naturally separate out from the lighter sperm, which scientists can then suck up using small pipettes, freeze in liquid nitrogen to maintain their viability, and later thaw in order to fertilize eggs. Once the embryo is created, it too can be frozen and kept for later release. It's like IVF, but for coral babies.
Okay, but the big if is climate change is only accelerating. So even if we lovingly rear these corals in the lab, will they stand a chance when we put them back into the warming, acidic seas?
Obviously, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if anyone knows the answer to that. However, I do know, you know, just having looked at ecosystems that do recover. I know when I was a teenager, a river was on fire. It had so much pollution in it. And today now they've cleaned up the river and there's salmon that now go up the river. And so I know ecosystems can rebound. So, you know, who knows whether the ocean will return to its, let's call it its pre-industrial condition or not. But it may return to conditions that are more amenable to coral, such as, you know, a pH of around 8 on a temperature of around, depending where you are on the planet, between, say, 26 and 28 degrees for coral. So, you know, I can imagine that perhaps those parameters might be met in the future. And it may be hundreds of years from now, but we can hold the material that long. We really can. If we do a good job, we can hold the material that long.
Well, One of the reasons why Mary is optimistic about being able to preserve and restore corals is the fact that she and her team have worked to make it an easy process for scientists around the world to participate in. This means that everyone, including eventually citizen scientists, can participate in the process of collecting and cryopreserving coral to help reach the goal of cataloging all existing coral species within the coral biobank. Getting finicky corals to produce sperm requires patience, good timing, and a microscope. But collecting coral fragments is as easy as pruning it off like a branch off a tree. These coral clone bits can then start their own colony, like how a plant cutting can grow into a full-size adult, as anyone with a green thumb might know.
We do things that are proof of concept, and that's great. You know, A, it works, hurrah, but that doesn't make it a restoration practice. You know, for example, we were able to cryopreserve coral larvae about 4 years ago using lasers to warm them. But that's not a restoration practice. People can't use lasers. They're not going to have them on the reef. You want something that's going to be simple and relatively easy to do and not complicated. And so we have a new process that we're using for freezing larvae that is really simple and really easy. And the same with the coral fragments. We're doing something that's extremely simple. It's conceptually very complex, but in reality, we have made it very simple. At the Smithsonian National Zoo, we have a course already, and actually how to make cryofreezers using 3D printers and how to do coral sperm cryopreservation. So we have many people around the world who are doing that already, you know, looking at the course, reading things, contacting us, and just doing it. It's really amazing.
Even with all the extra hands, though, ultimately saving this endangered habitat is a race against time.
I believe in 12 years that we will not have, or 15 years, we will no longer have coral reefs. So in my mind, I have 10 years left to really fundamentally bring all species of coral into captivity with my colleagues and to cryopreserve as much as we can. You know, I don't see us fundamentally changing. I think as species, we're flawed, you know, and we cannot look to the future and say, that makes sense, let's change our behavior. We're not doing that, and we are our worst enemies. We have the power to destroy the planet.
What Mary and her colleagues are doing is akin to battening down the hatches and stocking up on food as the storm hits. They know the storm will be a doozy, so best to hedge your bets and fill up your pantry through the worst of it. But with a threat as unpredictable and unrelenting as climate change, other scientists have taken a different approach. Instead of sheltering from the storm, they are meeting this daunting and new threat head on. Why not change species? Either by leveraging this trusty agent of selection known as evolution, or by directly manipulating the species genetically to help them ride out the storm. Andrew Martin is trying just that.
My name's Andrew Martin. I'm a professor at University of Colorado in Boulder, and my work in this realm has focused mostly on species that are isolated more or less to small populations that are stuck there in a small population eking out an existence. And so our work has sort of identified these populations of mostly species of fish, and then to try to make it so that they're best prepared for a changing world.
When Andrew talks about an isolated species, he means stuck in a living room-sized hole in the barren Nevada desert, kind of isolated. He's referring to the Devil's Hole pupfish, an inch-long, bright blue species of fish that makes its home in these bathtub-hot, mouth-puckeringly salty waters. The pupfish is well adapted to these seemingly hostile conditions, which makes sense given that it has likely been living there for the last few thousand years, back when the desert was swamped by a shallow sea. As the water retreated, pockets of water were left behind, along with whatever creatures happened to live in them. Today, there are only a few hundred left, local maximum. A decade ago, the population dipped down to only 35 living individuals. Isolated? Check. Endangered? Check. This was what Andrew came for.
Yeah, so the Devil's Hole pupfish lives in the middle of the desert in Nevada, literally in a hole in the little small pool at the top of a giant aquifer. So there's a little shelf in this deep sort of cavern. It ekes out a living, and it's been there for as long as we know. It's probably tens of thousands of years. As the world dried out, as the Pleistocene sort of ebbed away, because in the West, it was a much wetter place than it is today. There's giant lakes, and there's probably lots of water in the Mojave Desert. So as it's been drying out, it was just basically isolated there. It's been doing great for as long as, you know, it's been there, literally, and until humans sort of got involved. Kind of ironically, one of the first assaults to them were biologists who were interested in collecting and examining and documenting diversity on the planet. And they collected enormous numbers of these fish early in the 1930s. And they didn't really understand that if you have a small population and you remove a bunch of individuals, the problems of being in a small population get worse. And the biggest problem is that there's inbreeding. If you're inbreeding a lot, you're allowing these deleterious alleles that are produced every generation by mutation to sort of gain a foothold in the population and cause individuals to have lower fitness.
A bad gene, or in scientists speak, a deleterious allele, can mean many different things for an organism's ability to survive, and most importantly, pass on its genes. In the case of the devil's hole pupfish, the accumulation of these deleterious alleles made it such that sperm had a hard time fertilizing eggs. If the fertilization process went smoothly, the embryos sometimes failed to develop normally.
And the other thing that happens in small populations is that selection isn't very strong like it is in big populations. So selection has a hard time weeding out these individuals that carry deleterious mutations. And so if you run the tape of evolution through time, over time, these populations enter what's called the extinction vortex. And so we know from recent genomics work that sequenced the genome and found that there are all these mutations in their genome that are just bad. They just make things so they don't work well. So they have very poor fertilization success. Early development fails a lot in a lot of individuals. And it's not clear that this was due to accelerated anyway by humans collecting them, or if it was a natural process and maybe the world should just be allowed to do what it's going to do, because small populations at the fringe of their distribution often go to extinct as a natural part of just biodiversity on the planet.
As Andrew was saying, in small populations, there is much more inbreeding, meaning that these bad genes concentrate in a high proportion of individuals within that population. And as the population shrinks more and more due to climate change, habitat loss, or other human-driven impacts, the problem just gets worse. These genes become more and more entrenched in the population even as it drives down the genetic fitness of the species. This leads to that scary extinction vortex that Andrew was referring to.
Right, and on top of the conservation no-nos of overeager scientists in the 1930s, there is an ever-expanding list of threats to the pupfish. Earthquakes hit the region pretty frequently, knocking eggs off of ledges where they wait to hatch. Once, the scientists left fish traps around the pool, only for them to be swept up into a hole by flash flood, killing a quarter of the population. On top of that, the ever-expanding cities of southern Nevada, I'm looking at you, Vegas, they have been draining the aquifers that feed Devil's Hole, removing valuable habitat. Lastly, a hotter climate means this stagnant pool of water is also getting hotter, past what even the hardiest of fish can withstand. With all that's working against them, it's a miracle these fish are still around. But without an intervention, hopefully one that's a bit less destructive than those in the past, these fish might not make it much longer. The question is, what to do?
We're changing the environment really fast. How do we best prepare them for the future? So I worked a lot with people to try to get them to think about what are the possible solutions. And there were two camps. One camp was all about metabolism, that we really needed to augment their food resources. If they had enough food, they'd do fine, they'd reproduce, and everything would be hunky-dory. I was from the camp of where genetics really matters in terms of function of organisms. And if we don't address the issue of deleterious mutations, no amount of food is going to help. That they're fundamentally flawed because they can't purge these deleterious mutations. And the best way you can prepare populations to survive is to give them variation. The only way things survive is that they have all these different possible solutions to the climate change that's going on. And so if you give them more of them, it's more likely that one of them or a couple of those genetic solutions will be successful in a world that's hotter and drier. That's what's going to happen in the desert.
So what Andrew and his team did was cross Devil's Hole pupfish with a very closely related species, the Amargosa Valley pupfish, which lives in another pool fed by the same aquifer, but has been luckier than Devil's Hole pupfish and has not been met with quite the same challenges.
And so the plan was then to selectively and judiciously cross two individuals or some number of individuals and then back cross them into the Devil's Hole pupfish genome, and sort of any allele that was bad would then have a good copy in this other species. It would come in and serve like a Band-Aid.
These results were super promising.
The offspring were awesome. And now what's kind of cool is that people in different places are just discovering this idea that we can use general principles of evolution to help us promote adaptation. So that's sort of the key, and I'm hoping someday, and maybe convince the agency biologist, we really need to do something different than just add more food.
While Andrew has not actively worked on using genetic tools to actually go in and cut out deleterious mutations or insert protective genes, others in the field have started exploring that approach as an alternative to letting natural selection take its course. But while this may be one of the best ways to protect these imperiled species in the here and now, as climate change and other threats loom over us, some scientists argue that in doing so, we are losing what makes biodiversity on our planet so unique. In other words, by changing the species' genetics, even for their benefit, by altering their genome through artificial selection, or by hybridizing a species with another, we are losing what makes a species its own special entity.
Every single species is changing all the time, and they're not the same species that they were a generation ago, even though they're very similar, right? So it's a gradation thing. It's just like our cells replicate in our body and replace themselves every day. And over time, we're not the same person biologically. So I think we need to get away from this idea, because the agency biologists talk a lot about purity and like there's this thing that we need to preserve. But evolution has never been about that. It's always been about the key to survival is having the capacity to be able to change as a population. So my feeling is that if we're going to do conservation biology, we shouldn't get stuck in thinking of the typological thinking where you're like, this thing needs to be saved just as it is, or we need to bring things back to historical conditions, because we've changed the world so much that the types that we favor as being perfect representations of the things they want to save no longer can live in the places that we now have created, the environments we've created for them.
Unfortunately, there were disagreements on the best way to go about hybridizing and reintroducing the pupfish, and funding was cut. But Andrew thinks despite everything that has plagued these tiny fish and threatened their habitat, these fish are resilient beyond their size.
I think there'll be water in the desert for a while. Like, there's sort of a proliferation of little like straws sucking on the water on the aquifer all over the place because southern Nevada is still growing. I think the water issue is one of those things, though, that there'll be enough water for pupfish even when humans are emigrating or moving out of places because there's not enough water. I mean, these populations can survive in very small pools of water and reach pretty high population sizes. So I do think that in the long game, even in 100 years from now, there'll still be pupfish out in the Mojave Desert in various wet spots that dot the landscape.
Just in case, though, Andrew took a page out of Mary's book.
They also built this gigantic replica of the Devil's Hole in the middle of the desert, just downstream from Devil's Hole. It's a huge, huge pool that has the same shape. And we did a bunch of work there on the community of organisms. There's pupfish in there, and they have been reproducing, and they're kind of helping them reproduce by bringing the females and males out of the pool, putting them into tanks, letting them breathe, then taking the fish out, putting it back in the pool, and then fostering the babies. So there has been some sort of facilitated reproduction. As far as I know, I haven't been paying too much attention lately because my interest has sort of drifted. But if I was called into action at any time, I'd definitely be there.
So far, we've heard from Mary Hagedorn, whose strategy has been that of stockpiling for the hard times to come. Andrew Martin thinks we can change species, either through artificial selection or through genetic modification, to armor them against a changing world. But sometimes, the answer might be just to up and move.
My name is Jacqueline Lopez. I am a professor at Stetson University College of Law, where I direct a clinic for democracy and the environment. Prior to that, I was a senior attorney and the Florida director with the Center for Biological Diversity. My academic research and my litigation docket includes matters that have to do with the climate crisis, biodiversity, and impacts to communities. And I do this out of Florida, which is pretty much ground zero for a lot of the climate change impacts.
One of Jacqueline's main focuses is how we can use assisted migration, which is exactly what it sounds like, to help imperiled species combat climate change, whether that's literally uprooting plants threatened by the rising sea levels and replanting them inland, or shifting a population threatened by rising temperatures to higher, cooler ground.
In some way, it's ironic to think of plants as moving anywhere, though, of course, humans are going to be the ones doing the moving. But as anyone who's tried to lovingly care for a needy plant in their own home, you know that even something as seemingly chill and go with the flow as a humble houseplant can be hard to get right.
Also depends on like the biology of that plant. You know, some of them are cloning species,
in which the offspring is genetically identical to a parent, like a cutting or branch that can sprout by itself when removed from its original plant.
And so it might be easier to relocate in some instances a species that self-clones versus one that you have to propagate in a greenhouse and then move around somewhere else. Each of those plant species have unique needs. And so it just depends on what those unique needs and also what the opportunities are. What is the availability of the new habitat? Because some of it's on private land. And so you have to have willing landowners where you can bring those new plants to, like what's happening like in the U.S. Virgin Islands, for example, with some plant species of agave, where they're being moved from private area to private area. And when an area gets hit by a hurricane, well, you have some habitat over here, you help restore this area over here, and then you carefully monitor it and document the success and what works and what doesn't. Each of those plant species have unique needs, and so it just depends on what those unique needs and also what the opportunities are. What is the availability of the new habitat? Because some of it's on private land, and so you have to have willing landowners where you can bring those new plants to, like what's happening like in the U.S. Virgin Islands, for example, with some plant species of agave, where they're being moved from private area to private area. And when an area gets hit by a hurricane, well, you have some habitat over here, you help restore this area over here. And then you carefully monitor it and document the success and what works and what doesn't. It could be just like there's evidence that the species either historically existed in this space, but as a consequence, let's say, of human impacts, doesn't as densely populate those areas. And perhaps those areas have the possibility of being restored. Well, that's a really good opportunity for that habitat to be restored and for species to be assisted to that new location. But then there are other examples where it's maybe more speculative, or it's like a similar habitat type and we hope that it could be useful. But yeah, there are huge limitations where we're talking about coastal species being moved further inland. I don't actually see a pathway for that happening. Coastal dependent species, that's not going to change. And so for those species, it's really important that we're making sure that we're not going to rapidly erode available beaches, that we're not increasing our development pressure in those coastal areas, which shrinks the availability of the habitat, and that we're looking as already species are slowly, sea turtles, for example, are slowly migrating northward, that we're protecting those beaches that are seeing increasing density as they move north.
According to Jacqueline, many of the most successful instances of assisted migration have featured plants. Plants are stationary, so whatever environment they're in is what they have to adapt to. That means that as seas rise, they are especially threatened by rising salinity in the soils and the threat of habitat loss.
plants actually provide a really great example of how assisted migration can be successful and how it already has been successful in the United States for over 20 years. Because we've been experiencing sea level rise, documented sea level rise. And so some of our coastal plant species have been moved upland. And so maybe their habitat preference is for a certain salinity, but it's a very narrow range. Well, that still works out for certain species where we have inundation underground with salinity. So there's still that range of preference, but it's farther away from a coastal area that is now experiencing much more intense salinity or even inundation. One of the species that I write about is the Florida key tree cactus. And that's an example of successful reintroduction. Sometimes they call it reintroduction too. It just depends on what the historic range of the species is. And that's because we see greater numbers now than we had at the beginning of that project.
Jacqueline emphasizes that while Floridian habitats are particularly threatened because of sea level rise, assisted migration is a tool that can be applied in many different places and in many different contexts. The checker spot butterfly is endemic to the San Francisco Bay region of California, where it used to be widespread. Today, this butterfly species is extinct in many Bay Area counties, and its remaining population is small and isolated, largely as a result of pesticide use and human development, but also because of rising temperatures.
So looking at species of butterfly that only live in the mountains in California, for example, the Kino checkered spot butterfly, the recognition that the species does really well at certain altitudes, and those altitudes are changing based on precipitation and based on temperature. And so just making sure that those habitats in other mountainous areas nearby are available for the butterfly to persist is an important mission of the Fish and Wildlife Service. And the same is true for so many other species. I mean, the majority of the species that the Fish and Wildlife Service has identified as needing special protections, federal protections, the majority of them that have recovery plans speak about either their reintroduction or their assisted migration. And many of those deal with it in the context of climate change.
But assisted migration doesn't always work.
Like, for example, the Virgin Islands tree boa. And so this is like a really reclusive, it's non-venomous, it's a brown slender snake. You barely even notice that they're there, but they've lost a lot of habitat. Part of the habitat is because of human development, and part of that is because of the introduction of, unintentional introduction of rats and other things that eat the snake. And so there were attempts to reintroduce or to bring into other islands the tree boa, in the hope that you could bring enough of them there and keep all of the predators at bay and that they would survive and thrive. And it worked for a short period of time, but the presence of those species, those invasive species, is so strong and so persistent that the tree boa won't survive on those islands without human intervention. So there are these instances where you learn that through the course of experimentation that you can't keep the habitat conditions ideal, just, you know, because we have set certain things so far into motion, and invasives is one of those problems that is very difficult to control.
Jacqueline mentioned that one of the other risks of assisted migration is a species hybridization event, which ironically is exactly what scientists like Andrew Martin are doing to save some of these endangered species.
Like for the Florida key deer, for example, which has adapted to life in the Florida Keys, isolated from the mainland of Florida. Mainland Florida has a different species of deer, has a white-tailed deer. And if you were to bring the Florida key deer, which is like a diminutive version of a deer, it's like a mini deer, and bring it over to the mainland, there's the possibility that it would be bred into extinction, so that it would lose its genetic uniqueness and no longer be a key deer. One of the, I would guess, like rhetorical policy problems with that is that we lose focus of what else should be on the table when we're talking about sacrificing, because you're sacrificing the genetic uniqueness of a species, which is effectively its extinction. Even if your effort is to save it, if you're changing it genetically, aren't you rendering it a different thing? And in which case, isn't that past lineage then extinct? And so what else should we be looking at? Well, what are the causes what are the threats that are resulting in the possibility of extinction? And why aren't those things on the same chopping block?
Deciding how best to preserve our world can be surprisingly challenging, and the devil really is in the details. Will moving this plant here mean the suffering and demise of another group of organisms? Is it right to introduce a species that will muddy the genetic identity of another species? But Jacqueline also brought up an important point. While the details may not be so straightforward, we all share the common goal of keeping our environment clean, healthy, and safe. This goal unites us across worlds and backgrounds.
Well, the one thing that I have noticed is as divided as our nation appears to be on so many political issues, it seems like the environment is not one of them. Like, you can have people that are on very different sides of abortion issues, on Second Amendment rights issues, on immigration. But I think the majority of us agree that we want fishable, swimmable, drinkable water, that we want air that we can breathe without a gas mask, that we want landscapes that we can enjoy that have biodiversity, that we have a climate that's relatively stable and we're not getting hammered by hurricanes on election day in November. So I think that there's a real opportunity for some of these issues to bridge a lot of those political divisions that we see currently. So I'm optimistic about that. I think that is a relatively new thing. I think that local awareness to the severity of the action, even if we can't agree on what the causes are at their root, we can all observe when we have toxic algae that makes our waters unapproachable, that you can't ignore that. And we can all agree that that's not good for our health, that's not good for our economy, and we can all get on board on doing something. You know, the devil's always in the details. What do we do about it? Electing the right people, putting in the right policies, punishing the polluters, all of those types of things we still need to get in lockstep on. But I think there's opportunity there.
Ourselves in the midst of a rapidly changing world, and there's no obvious way of dealing with it.
The real answer is we stop pumping carbon into the atmosphere and protect the species we have. But the reality is, beyond the big steps we can take, which themselves are complicated and contentious, there's still a lot of different approaches we can take when there's no consensus on what the right way is to go. And even if we were to stop all carbon emissions right now, today, we've shot up into the atmosphere so much carbon that the Earth will continue to warm and species will continue to die off. First, we heard from Mary, who takes samples of coral reefs from around the world to store in a frozen bank, so that they can be revived in the future as the wild coral reefs bleach and die. Next, we heard from Andrew, who's led an effort to save a critically endangered fish from extinction through artificial selection by managed breeding. And lastly, we spoke with Jacqueline, a law professor from Florida with a keen interest in assisted migration, or the literal translocation of plants and animals from place to place, as a valuable tool for rescuing species from changing and shrinking landscapes. There are caveats to each of these approaches, and not everyone agrees that these are the ways to go. Assisted migration and artificial selection can change species by altering their gene pool. The idea of a frozen bank makes some skeptical that we'll be motivated enough to make changes if we can always dip into that rainy day backup.
With the pace of climate change as it is, and human inaction as it also is, some of these efforts are all we have and what we need to ensure that we still have a shred of biodiversity to cling to, now and for future generations to come.
That's a wrap. Thanks for spending your time with us, learning about modern conservation strategies that scientists use in the face of climate change. This episode was directed by Deanna Nakula and narrated by Kie Shidara and me, Marilyn Steyard. Thanks to the whole CTOR team for valuable feedback along the way, and a huge thanks to Mary Hagedorn, Andrew Martin, and Jacqueline Lopez for sharing their work with us. This episode wouldn't have been possible without the generous support of our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to support us and our mission to spark curiosity in science, you can head over to patreon.com/carrytheone. We have Patreon rewards at every support level, and we're grateful for any amount of support. You can also share our podcast with everyone you know and leave us a review wherever you're hearing us. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook and start a conversation. Stay curious!